May it please the court, my name is Brad Young. I represent Gary Axelson, who is the appellant here. He should prevail for two reasons. First of all, the statutory employer provisions of Section 65.2302 apply to all downstream employees, that is, employees of subcontractors. Second, Mr. Axelson was a downstream employee, namely of Generation Builders, which was an independent contractor on the job site where Mr. Axelson worked.
But Generation Builders has been dismissed, and so if you chain through them, how do we get there?
Well, the fact that it's dismissed doesn't detract from the fact that he was an employee on the job site. And the Section 65.2302, the commission said that it applies only to employees of uninsured subcontractors. The statutory language states that it makes the owner or contractor, as the case may be, liable to any worker employed in the work, as if the worker had been immediately employed by the owner or contractor. So whether or not Generation Builders had been dismissed, the fact remains that Mr. Axelson was its employee at the time of his injury.
Yeah, can I start with one of the basic questions? Is you did not name 31 LLC as a party in this appeal. So as far as 31 LLC is concerned, the commission's ruling is final, correct?
Respectfully, Judge, we disagree with that.
Your argument is the uninsured employer fund is the real party in interest.
The issue is whether 31 LLC is a necessary party to this appeal. That's the issue. None of the appellees has found it significant enough to file a motion to dismiss based on that. If the court,
but it's not just whether they're a necessary party; it's whether the commission's findings as to or holding as to 31 LLC is final.
The commission did not on review. We argued that Mr. Axelson, that 31 LLC was liable because it had was in the same trade or business. The commission never reached that, so that there is no ruling on the reasons.
But the bottom line is the commission said they are not the employer of Mr. Axelson.
Not the full commission. The full commission ruled on two legal issues. First, they said that Section 65.2302 requires an uninsured subcontractor. And then they said that Mr. Axelson simply could not qualify as an employee because of their interpretation of 65.
But their ruling regarding 31 LLC, effectively, your theory was 31 LLC could be liable as the employer. The commission issues a final decision. The final decision finds that 31 LLC is not liable. And therefore, unless you attack the judgment against 31 LLC, how in the world can we ever create a situation where it's conceivable that they're his employer and liable in some fashion? How do we undo that if it's not appealed to us?
Well, Mr. Axelson has appealed the two rulings the commission made. It is true that 31 LLC, which did not appear in the proceeding below, that was a rookie mistake on my part. I acknowledge that. Nevertheless, the issues the commission ruled upon are here. 31 LLC's interests are fully represented by the UEF.
But isn't the uninsured fund, essentially, for lack of a better term, an insurance company in this circumstance? I mean, they're not technically an insurance company. Over their objection, could 31 LLC have settled this claim and paid out of pocket?
I'm not familiar enough with the uninsured employer statute portion of the act to know that, frankly. My point is,
but if 31 LLC's liability is extinguished, then it seems to me necessarily so that the UIE's any potential UIE liability is extinguished.
I do not have an answer to that now.
Well,
but I would request leave to brief it. If the court obviously is going to, on its own motion, entertain whether or not 31 Limited is a necessary party. And I, again, there's
I just don't see where we have jurisdiction over 31 LLC.
And the case, I sent a letter to the court shortly after I filed my reply brief, where the Supreme Court in the Lamar Company versus City of Richmond, 287 Virginia 322, the billboard company leased land from landowners and got into a zoning fight, and for some reason the landowners did not end up as appellants before the Supreme Court, and they said the billboard company sufficiently represents their interest.
Well, you would agree here that if we were to embrace your theory of the case, that 31 LLC would have some liability here. That would be your position, correct?
My position is that the commission has never ruled on that. That's why we're essentially in an...
Let's make it even a little bit more basic. Potentially would have liability.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we have that as the standard, and we look at the Watkins versus Fairfax County Department of Family Services case, where it says specifically, where an individual is in actual enjoyment of the subject matter or has an interest in it, either in possession or expectancy, which is likely either to be defeated or diminished by the plaintiff's claim, in such a case he has an immediate interest in resisting demand, and all persons who have such immediate interest are necessary parties to the suit. So in other words, as I read that language from the case, is that if there's any potential or exposure as far as liability is concerned, it is incumbent upon the party going forward to name all parties, individuals, and the like who are potentially responsible for the liability associated with your claim.
I am not familiar with that decision, Your Honor.
In the case you cited, if I heard you correctly, you said the Supreme Court said who should have been named it. That you didn't have all of the potential appellants.
Well,
it strikes me as fundamentally different when we're dealing with a potential appellee, because that's somebody who won below, and if mm-hmm. if they're going to lose that win, they need to be invited to the party.
I see your point, Judge. Again, I would respectfully request leave to brief this issue if the court is going to rule on it, because again, this is
Let's move on to Pfeiffer, and we can get into the merits of the case.
And in any event, Pfeiffer is still a freestanding appellee here, regardless of what happens with 31.
In order to be deemed an employee under 65.2-101N, let's talk about N only,
yes, sir,
at this point. Two things have to. The statute requires two things: election and notice to the workers' compensation carrier.
Mm-hmm.
What evidence, let's start with the first, what evidence in the record is there that that Mr. Axelson elected to be deemed an employee?
Mr. Axelson did not, there is no evidence that he, that the elements of 65.2-101-1N, that he satisfied that. He did not satisfy
that. I thought you were making your argument that under N, he was an employee of Generation
Builders.
too many players there. Generation. He was an employee of Generation Builders, and therefore a statutory employee of Pfeiffer.
Our argument is that the deputy commissioner found him to be an employee of Generation Builders under a contract of hire between him and Generation Builders, which is a separate legal entity. That's under 65.2-101-1A.
So you're conceding that N does not apply in this case.
Well, my argument is the commission sees 1N as the umbrella. That's the only way you can, that it, the member of a single...
I understand that, but are you conceding the commission was right as to N and saying, but they didn't deal with A?
I'm saying I concede that he did not, that his LLC,
You don't concede the commission's interpretation of the effect of not complying.
Correct.
And you concede that they correctly found he didn't comply with
it. There is no evidence that he elected to be treated as an employee, but that's the cutting issue. The commission says that 1N excludes all other definitions. In other words, the commission says we can disregard generation builders as a separate legal entity that the General Assembly has authorized and the Limited Liability Company Act. There's no separation between Mr. Axelson and Generation Builders because he didn't comply with 1N. There are three reasons that's wrong. First of all, this court's decision in Compton-Waldrop versus Virginia Beach Police says an individual is covered by the act only if he or she qualifies as an employee under subsections 1B through Q, or disjunctive, is in the service of another under a written or implied contract. The deputy commissioner found that Mr. Axelson was an employee of Generation Builders. Implicitly, he found there's no discussion in the deputy commissioner's opinion of 101.1N. Therefore, Mr. Axelson was an employee, and the commission affirmed the deputy commissioner's opinion. They just said he didn't qualify under 101.1N, therefore he can't ever be an employee. And that's completely contrary to this court's decision in Compton-Waldrop. Second, if you look at the express language of 101N,
let me stop you there. The deputy commissioner's opinion says, taken as a whole, we conclude that the claimant's involvement with the project was based solely in his capacity as the managing member / employee of Generation Builders. So I'm not sure that's actually a finding that he is an employee, because he also, he says managing member. Mm-hmm. So it could be either or. He didn't make a finding. He just said it's one or the other, and it doesn't matter which, because he's not an employee of the other two organizations.
Or he said both.
Can you be both?
Yes. Under the law, you can. That's common. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Justin Main, and I represent the Uninsured Employers Fund. Just as an initial matter, Your Honors, counsel for Pfeiffer Construction and I were going to split our time equally, 7.5 minutes, so I'm going to be relatively brief today. Let me touch on first the issue of 31 LLC being a necessary party. Mr. Sundberg briefed that more extensively in his brief, so I'll let him touch on that. But in terms of the UEF representing the interests of 31 LLC, I can definitively tell you that is not the case. I've been doing UEF work for a long time. Our interests diverge. If there's an award against 31 LLC, they are responsible for paying that award. And if they don't pay that award within 30 days after a demand is made on them to pay it, the Uninsured Employers Fund can step in.
But the statute requires, as I read it, an award against 31 LLC before the fund is responsible for anything.
Exactly, Your Honor.
And if we have no jurisdiction over 31 LLC, then you have no responsibility to pay any award that might be entered.
Exactly, yes. Our liability only attaches if 31 LLCs does, and then we would have a right of subrogation against any monies that we pay.
And assuming approved by the commission, if 31 LLC, without contacting you, without communicating with you, without doing anything, resolve their Mr. Axelson's claim against them, you would have no say as to whether they could stop it, not do it, whatever. If the commission approved it, it's over.
I would be thrilled, Your Honor, if that happened. I would. It has happened every once in a while, but not very often from an uninsured employer. But yes, no, that could happen. Is another initial matter. Repeatedly in Mr. Axelson's briefs, you see references to the deputy commissioner's finding that Mr. Axelson was an employee, and that is somehow binding on us all now because the full commission affirmed the deputy commissioner's opinion. But the full commission, after deciding that Mr. Axelson was not an employee, a direct employee of 31 LLC, or a direct employee of Pfeiffer Construction, they went on to address the issue of whether he was an employee of Generation Builders. And their quote from the full opinion is, "We are therefore left with the question of whether the claimant qualified as an employee of Generation Builders." That's really the issue. Was he an employee of Generation Builders? And they went on and they found in the very next paragraph, they said there's two reasons that he is not.
But they never addressed whether he was a subsection A employee. employee, did they?
They did not, Your Honor.
They simply addressed N.
They did, yes, exactly. And that actually would bring me to my second point, which you know, what's the definition of employee? And we look to Section 101, 1A through T for that. And under 101, 1A, there's a pretty broad definition of employee, which more or less includes any person in the service of another under a contract for hire. And then B through T, there are 19 more specific, narrow definitions of employee. One of those is 1N. I would argue that Mr. Axelson clearly doesn't qualify under 1A. He's not in the service of another. He's the owner of a business that he created. He's the sole member of the LLC that he created. He's not in the service of another. And so he doesn't fit squarely within 1A. And then opposing counsel cites Compton Waltrip in support of their contention that he does qualify as an employee under 1A. But this court in that case held that if no contract to pay wages for hire can be implied from the facts, a person is not an employee under subsection 1A. Mr. Axelson clearly doesn't meet this definition. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that he was under a contract for hire or that he earned any wages. He's the only evidence is that he was the owner. I don't even think he ever referred to himself as the sole member, but let's, for argument's sake, say that he is. There's no other evidence about his relationship to the business. So then I think you move on to the other subsections, and you see if he qualifies under those, and we look at subsection 1N, which, as Your Honor stated, you have to elect to be covered, and you have to notify your insurance carrier. Well, that presupposes that you have an insurance policy in place.
I think you've gotten a concession that N's not at issue. You can spend any time on.
Exactly, Your Honor. The reason I bring up N is just N is there for a reason. It's under the definition of employee for a reason, and it's to cover sole members of LLCs, to cover other executive officers and corporations. The subsection right under that covers independent contractors. It covers individuals that don't otherwise fall under 1A. And so that subsection was placed there for a reason, and if you could qualify under 1A or 1N, then I think you're left with a somewhat absurd result where you could be an employee by not following the dictates of 1N, and you could qualify as an employee by following the dictates of 1N. So basically 1N would be completely meaningless and devoid of meaning if 1A was the be-all, end-all of the definition of employee and if it covered Mr. Axelson's case. There's a lot of talk about the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act to protect employees. Well, Mr. Axelson was an owner. He could have gone and obtained a policy. He could have elected to be covered under that policy. He could have been treated as an employee. He could have had the protections of the Workers' Compensation Act. The act is designed to put the burden on employers, to put the burden on him as the owner of his company to obtain insurance if he deemed that necessary and if he wanted to be covered. I think they're trying to get a workaround now where he can be covered under someone else's policy or the state, in this case the uninsured employer's fund, when in reality he should have just gotten his own policy. The last thing that I want to bring up real briefly is the full commission statement that an uninsured employer is a prerequisite for claiming under section 65.2-302, the statutory employer statute. That statute clearly doesn't come out and say that definitively, but I think that's the clear intent of that statute. And I don't think it is decisive in this case today because regardless, you still have to be an employee of a subcontractor to claim under 302. But I think it's very clear that statute was designed to protect the employees of financially irresponsible or unscrupulous employers that don't have insurance. Their argument is, well, you could be an employee of an insured subcontractor and you could just go claim right against the statutory employer. You could file your workers' compensation claim against the general contractor and just skip your employer altogether. I think that leads there's several things that leads to. It's a waste of judicial resources and it serves absolutely no purpose. I see that I've already gotten to 7.5 minutes, so I will step back, but I would ask that Your Honor affirm the full commission's decision. Thank you.
Mr.
Good morning. May it please the court. Alan Sundberg appearing on behalf of Pfeiffer Construction in Erie. I largely am in line with everything that Mr. Main has presented to you.
What he said.
What he said is good for me. What the commission said is good for me.
Let me ask you
and we line up behind those
decisions.
Let me
ask you this question about the subsection A argument. That was not addressed by the commission at all. And as I look back, I think one of the reasons it wasn't addressed by the commission is that I don't really see it included in the appeal from the deputy commission. I don't see it really in the argument. I see it really first appearing in a motion to reconsider. And I wonder what your position would be on whether that was properly preserved before the commission.
That's an interesting question, which truly I have not given much consideration to. I would note that the particular issues on appeal changed over time as this matter went forward, and I think that certainly may have contributed to what the commission was looking at. And I think the commission's determination was we're not dealing with an employee situation here. We are dealing with an independent contractor, and the statutory employer language does not apply here. He's basically done on the employee issue.
The commission's whole decision in this case revolved around whether or not he was an employee under subsection N.
Correct, Your Honor.
And apparently that is no longer at issue. So I'm hard-pressed to find where we are with this appeal.
I'm not sure what to tell Your Honor on that. It does seem that the issues are...
As a statement of appellate principles, as I understand it, one of the big differences between bringing an appeal to us as opposed to bringing to one to the commission is obviously it's well established that you can't bring an argument to us that wasn't raised with the commission.
Correct, Your Honor.
My understanding of the commission's rules and practice is it is possible to bring an appeal of an issue that you didn't raise to the deputy commissioner to the full commission. But that's at their discretion. They can hear it or not hear it as they wish.
That is also correct, Your Honor.
Is their opinion only dealing with a tacit rejection of the A argument that was not made to the deputy commissioner? Or a tacit we're not hearing it? Did they ever affirmatively say they were going to hear it?
I'm not aware that they did, Your Honor. I'm not aware of that. Perhaps counsel would know that better. I don't recall seeing that.
I didn't hear.
We'll get to you.
Don't worry.
If there are no further questions, thank you
very much.
The UEF's counsel states that Mr. Axelson was an owner of the business he created. Again, that gets to the cutting issue here. Does 101.1N authorize the ignoring the fact that Generation Builders under the law is a separate legal entity? It's established. Mr. Pfeiffer was at the hearing and he was the representative of Pfeiffer Construction. He was also the representative and testified as the managing member of 31 Limited, which is also an LLC. Why doesn't Generation Builders get the same deference as a separate legal entity?
I want to ask you about your where we are now in light of your assignment of error. Your assignment of error, the Workers' Compensation Commission erred in finding that for any employee seeking statutory employee status, a fundamental element of proof is establishing that he was an employee of an uninsured subcontractor.
Mm-hmm.
That implicates N, correct? The uninsured subcontractor language has nothing to do with A.
Correct.
You have told us that N is no longer an issue that we have to resolve. So how does A come under that assignment of error? How is that included in your assignment of error?
A is included in the second assignment of error, where we say the second assignment of error encompasses the A argument. We discuss A in our discussion in the brief itself.
But the second assignment of error, even more specifically, refers to N and not A.
Well, but it says the commission erred in saying that N is the only way you can be an employee, and it sufficiently brings to the fore the issue of, is that the only way or is A another way?
If we agree with your assignments of error and say, you're right, the commission erred in its interpretation of N, we couldn't do anything because N has nothing to do with this appeal.
It has, from our perspective, it has everything to do because the commission says that N covers the field and that it blots out all other definitions of employee, and our argument is there's no support for that. There's support the other way.
You intend the assignments of error to say that the commission ruled that this is the exclusive way.
Yes, Judge.
Implicitly in that, there are other ways.
Exactly, and we address that in the...
Let me ask you the question as to that. Where was that argument presented to the commission?
In the motion to reconsider, which I filed because the commission ruled on entirely different grounds from what it went up on review.
But A was never argued either at the deputy commissioner level or before the full commission, and it was not included in the expanded assignments of error, for want of a better term, in the appeal.
I see that my time is expired.
Please go ahead and address that.
I believe my motion to reconsider addressed A.
It did.
Yeah. And again, the reason the motion for reconsider stemmed from the fact, again, that the commission, from our perspective, ruled on totally different ground. And so our first opportunity to address that was via the motion to reconsider, because it went up on review on totally different grounds.
I think Judge Russell has one final question.
I promised I would ask you the question that you said you couldn't hear.
Yes, sir.
And that is this. The way I understand the rules is, of course, we can't hear anything that wasn't presented to the commission. But mm-hmm. The commission, at its discretion, can hear things that weren't presented to the deputy commissioner mm-hmm. or in the initial statements of you. Given how you raised the A argument and when you raised the A argument, is there any indication that the commission decided that it would entertain it as opposed to not entertain it at all?
We filed our motion to reconsider on April 10th. They filed an order denying it on April 13th.
Not a lot of consideration.
Just anyway. A bare order that said we deny your motion to reconsider.
But they don't give a reason. They don't.
No, sir.
So
yes.
it could have been because it hadn't been raised before.
Well,
and I understand you think there was no way for you to have anticipated it.
I would have had to have been clairvoyant.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll